Hello, and welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're sitting here in the studios of KALW Information Radio in San Francisco.
But we're continuing conversations that get started at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus. The Stanford campus, home of privileged professors and privileged students and privileged administrators, all busily eating and drinking and more than their share of the world's resources and using up more than their share of the world's oil.
So that's
Is that a problem?
Yeah, that's, well, I don't know about Stanford locally being a world's problem, but, you know, it is a problem that collectively we're consuming an awful lot. And our consumption has bad effects on the environment. I mean, the ozone layer is being depleted. I mean, the rainforests are being are diminishing. And it looks like it just can't go on. If it keeps going on this way, future generations are going to have heck to pay.
Well, you know, one thing about global warming is that it rivets everybody's attention, and it's somewhat controversial, but there's so much going on that doesn't seem very controversial, like the ozone layer, people in Australia having to wear shirts when they go outside and so forth. Things have changed because of what the first world has done to the environment.
Well, the first world's done a lot of it, but if we want to have a sustainable way of life, a global way of life that's sustainable, something's got to give. And you're suggesting, I think, that, well, something has to give in the first world, so we should give up our high standard of living so that what, the third world can catch up?
I don't know. I see kind of a real dilemma there, Ken. I think the third world, if it goes through the same form of development that the first world did, denude the forest, kill the animals, it'll be awful. But on the other hand, it doesn't seem very fair to say that, oh, you know, all of a sudden, all corporations have to pay their share of the environmental damage they do, and economic growth will be saddled with all these things. That doesn't seem very fair. So I've got a problem there.
We're going to make them live by standards that we never lived by to get here. Of course, I guess we would live by those same standards going forward or something. So, I mean, we would, you know, we would pay some of the freight. But
well,
they'd probably never catch up, is what you're suggesting.
And, well, they
well,
might.
Do they deserve to catch up?
I mean,
we're running the race. Why do they deserve to catch up? Are we supposed to slow down and let them catch up?
You don't think all those people in China deserve 30 or 40 years in which they kind of guiltless drive polluted vehicles all over the place?
I don't know. Yeah, it doesn't seem to me that they deserve it. Maybe they're demanding it, and maybe given their demand, and, you know, and China's not like a little weak a powerless country. China's a big, powerful force in the world, and it's going to get even more powerful.
So suppose we say to China, no, now you can't do it the way we did. You can't have years of running kind of cheaply built, inexpensively engineered vehicles that pollute a lot. You have to immediately step into these computer-based things that we drive now that an ordinary person like myself can't hope to repair. Is that what we have to say? Is that fair?
Well, I don't know. I wonder what the Chinese have to say about that. You know, our roving philosophical reporter, Amy Standen, we asked her to investigate the problem of China, the world's most populous nation. She files this report.
China is the world's fastest growing auto market. Car sales for 2003 were 80% higher than they were in 2002. That's great if you're Chinese and late for work, but from an environmental standpoint, it spells trouble.
I mean, I think China is facing an environmental crisis on many fronts.
Jennifer Turner is the coordinator of the China Environment Forum for the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. She's watched Chinese oil consumption grow dramatically over the last two decades.
For auto oil consumption, they consume approximately 1.6 million barrels a day. Now, that's not much compared to a lot of developing countries, but if they follow a scenario of going the SUV route, not improving their fuel economy, driving the way we drive, many, many miles a day, they're going to get up to, in 2020, up to 24.8 million barrels of oil a day. And that's just for cars.
That's an enormous amount of oil. We Americans drive more than anyone else in the world. Our cars burn 9 million barrels of oil a day, less than half of what China may soon need. And cars are only part of China's economic explosion. With prosperity comes bigger homes, air conditioning, disposable cameras, plasma TVs.
I mean, you have to keep in mind that there was a lot of pent-up consumerism in China. Now, as China's opened up, I mean, it's just amazing how much these people love to shop. You can see the impacts of China's development by looking in your own closets, looking in your own kitchen drawers, how many things say made in China on it. I mean, their economy is booming because we're also buying the stuff that they're producing. Our companies are going over there, creating joint ventures. The Chinese are building up their own companies. I mean, economically, it's an explosion.
The question isn't only whether the Earth can support 1.3 billion American-style consumers in China, but whether the United States will let that happen. Recently, a watchdog committee in Washington released a report saying that Chinese efforts to increase oil supply were dangerous to U.S. interests.
And I was really struck by that because, in all reality, the Chinese international energy policy and their international energy investments looks a lot like what the United States does, trying to get enough oil resources both within our own country and the Middle East. And I just thought it was just very ironic that we're criticizing the Chinese for pursuing a pretty much similar international energy strategy that we are.
Americans can and do encourage China and the rest of the developing world to consume sustainably, to act more environmentally than we do. But at a certain point, something's got to give.
Mother Earth can't support the way we're living our lives right now. And we are raised to be massive consumers. And this has to stop.
There are simply not enough resources to go around, so who makes the sacrifice, them or us? This is Amy Standen for Philosophy Talk.
I'm John Perry, along with Ken Taylor. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Discussion today takes us around the world, global justice and the environment.
And joining us today in the studios of KLW is Professor Larry Goulder. He's a professor of economics at Stanford. He's actually the Shuzo Nishihara Professor in Environmental and Resource Economics.
Well done, Ken. Well done.
Yeah. He consults frequently with government and economic and environmental organizations about global environmental impact things. And he's recently written an article deeply relevant to what we're talking about called Are We Consuming Too Much? Larry, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Larry, I want to start by asking you a sort of a factual question, although not necessarily an uncontroversial question. We've kind of set up this problem of what's fair to the third world with two assumptions. First is that the way things are going is unsustainable and will be increasingly so if the third world consumes as much as the first world does. And secondly, if that problem is solved, the burden, at least in the most straightforward solution, will fall unfairly on the third world. Are those assumptions true, partly true, or totally wrong?
I think they're partly true. With regard to the first question, clearly our current way of life with present technologies and the environmental implications and implications for resources is not sustainable. Indeed, it's not only unsustainable for the developing world, for the poorer countries of the world, but it also is something which isn't sustainable for the richer countries of the world or the North. So we not only shouldn't be asking the developing countries to emulate our way of life in that respect, because it's impossible, but we ourselves cannot do so. There have been a number of studies which look at the future based on current technologies and indicate that there are very serious consequences for the longer term, both in terms of resource depletion, the depletion of exhaustible resources, as well as environmental effects. However, the way that your question that it's only partly true is that we can ask developing countries to try to emulate our quality of life or our standard of living. I'm making a distinction between our particular way of consuming today and overall well-being or quality of life. That is, we can ask, how can we provide energy services, home heating, cooking, energy for cooking, as well as transportation services in a way that doesn't end up relying so much on scarce, exhaustible resources and doesn't do so much damage to the environment? And the question is, how can that be done? And the key to that is new technologies, technological change, and the transition to renewable resources from conventional resources.
That sounds wonderful, you know, and it sounds like we could maybe have our cake and eat it too if we make these transitions to new technologies and all that. But and I take it some of these new technologies are probably on the horizon, but they're not in full-scale use anywhere around the world. And are we to say to the developing world, okay, look, we've all got this problem, and we've all got to move to new technologies and more sustainable way of life, but, you know, and when we get to these more sustainable technologies, you can come along for the ride. You can catch up. But until then, we're just going to increase our lead over you.
So we say to China, oh, hey, you can be just like us. Once we get on the hydrogen economy, you can be on the hydrogen economy too. Just don't use up too much oil in the meantime, or you'll really make us angry.
Yeah.
So, I think that's a great question, and I think history matters. The fact that the now industrialized world or the more industrialized world has, over the past several decades, contributed significantly, the lion's share, to resource depletion and to environmental degradation, I think that obliges the North to be the first mover and to take the largest steps in this direction. Over the longer term, I think that there is a case to be made for the developing countries to follow suit. And in the meantime, we can help the developing countries in the form of technology transfers and providing intellectual expertise so that their transition, even if it is somewhat slower than ours, that is the North's, can be made somewhat more quickly.
So now let me think of from the other side, though. Now you're saying we in the North, right, who got there first, how did we get there? Through exploration, investment, investing in our educational system. We did all these things. Now, of course, we did them in a way that had consequences, externalities, you economists like to say, that maybe we weren't so aware of there when we started, when we started doing the petrochemical industry and all that sort of stuff. But, through investment and technology and education and all that we got there. Now you're saying, well, okay, guys, you have to pay the cost of your having gotten there. You have to give up some things to let these guys get. Why am I obligated? I mean, if I don't want people to hate me, but if I'm the guy sitting in the first world who invested and saved and all that stuff, and I got the benefit of that, and now you're saying, well, they didn't do all those things. Now, if I had imposed those backward economic systems on them, that would have been one thing. But, it was Stalin. It was Mao. It wasn't me that imposed this backward system on them.
Wait a minute, Ken. Stalin and Mao, if you're talking about really undeveloped places, in the first place, I don't know why you say the economy was backward. Hunter-gatherers did just fine. A lot of economies were doing just fine. Deaf people like to say they're not really disabled.
Okay,
it's the problem. The problem they have is with hearing people. If they were on an island by themselves, they'd be fine.
It's Stalin and Mao. Pol Pot. Yeah. Or somebody. Oh, what are these third world dictators who kept their nations in check with the help of some elites in those nations? So now why should I have to,
Are you saying
that talking about obligation? I'm trying to figure out where this obligation comes from.
You're saying that the impetus among citizens in the North to take aggressive action to improve the environment will be harder to sell if they, at the same time, we're recognizing that nations in the South are not taking action and that their environmental problems are to a large extent caused by authoritarian regimes and other things that are outside of our control. We don't have an ethical obligation to help them.
Well, I'm wondering where our ethical obligations come from. I'm setting up a situation in which we didn't impose the structures on them that make them not up with us.
Well, right? I think there's a lot of particular cases you have to look at. I mean, look at the case of Haiti. I mean, there people have been drowning because they've denuded the forests and there's nothing to stop the floods. Is that our fault? Well, historically, if you look at the details, we really played a significant role in that. I think it's clear we have a moral obligation to help reforest and put that economy on a better thing. I suspect, given all the northern countries involved, the Englands, the Frances, the Germanys, and the U.S., you'd find a fairly clear path of guilt in most cases. That's just my humble opinion, Ken.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk as John pontificates. Our guest today is Professor Larry Goulder of Stanford University. You can join our discussion, and we're eager to have you join us, by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
You can consider this question we've just been asking. Do we in the first world have a moral duty to help others achieve Western-style consumption and comforts? What if doing so comes at the expense of our interests or a burden on the Earth's environment? Call us. Let us know. 415-841-4134. Or go to our website, philosophytalk.org, and send us a comment.
Philosophy Talk, we'll be right back.
The Talking Heads with Nothing But Flowers. I'm John Perry. We're back here, Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing global justice and the environment with our colleague Larry Goulder of Stanford University. We'd like you to join our conversation. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. Ken, we're debating, you and I were kind of debating about what we owe people in the third world. Now, can't we just apply the lessons I learned in graduate school in my ethics seminar, or John Rawls? Everything ought to be divided up equally, except in the case in which giving somebody more will benefit everybody, the so-called difference principle. Doesn't that apply internationally?
Well, you know, Larry was a student of Rawls as an undergraduate, I believe. You were an undergraduate philosophy major at Harvard, right?
That's correct.
With the great man Rawls. Let Larry take up that. Let Larry take up that question about where these obligations might come from.
Well, first of all, let me back up a second, because I think, Ken, you raised two questions. One is, should we be developing two new technologies here? And second, should we be transferring those technologies or providing financial assistance to developing countries to push them along? With respect to the first question, it's much in our own interest when you do a benefit-cost calculation of the benefits from these new technologies, both environmental and the avoidance of extra reliance on high-cost, non-renewable resources. This is in our own interest. So the real difficult issue is the question you focused on, namely, do we have an obligation to not only develop these technologies, but in some sense provide them to other countries, or to provide financial assistance so that the other countries can develop them on their own? My reading of Rawls, my old thesis advisor.
Yeah, one of the great political philosophers of the 20th century, you know, John Rawls.
Is that indeed the difference principle would apply internationally. Namely, that we should help reduce inequalities, both economic and social, as much as possible and bring up, as it were, those that have the least resources, so long as that doesn't end up pushing some other countries down at an even lower level. So
right.
Bring up the bottom as much as possible. Empirically, what this would mean is something quite different from where we are today. It would mean, if you think about the fact that the U.S. per capita income is more than five times the average per capita income for the globe, we'd end up, it would suggest that we'd be giving up a huge share of our resources to help develop other countries. Now, I should mention two things. One is that we obviously don't follow Rawls's prescription. There are competing ethical theories. If you take an approach such as that of Robert Nozick, which focuses more on property rights and being entitled to the fruits of your own labor, it would suggest a far more conservative approach. I'm not taking a stand on either, except to say that they're competing approaches. The other thing I was saying is that this is not, strictly speaking, an environmental question. This is a more general question of the distribution of wealth. I think there are other ethical issues that come up that are more strictly environmental that would indeed apply and would suggest changes to the way we conduct ourselves in the
U.S. What do you have in mind when you say that?
Well, one has to do with international pollution or transboundary pollution, as it's called. That is, when one country engages in activities which, say, production activities, which generate pollution, which then crosses national boundaries and leads to damage in other countries. You mentioned, Ken, at the beginning of the show, stratospheric ozone and the cost. So that, for example, when chlorofluorocarbons are used in the industrialized world, they end up being ozone-depleting, stratospheric ozone-depleting chemicals, and lead to a thinning of the ozone layer, and it leads to multiple problems, including increased skin cancers. Or in Peru, there's evidence of blind cows as a result of increased ozone. Another important example is the combustion of carbon-based fossil fuels, which the scientific evidence suggests that it would lead to significant changes in the world's climate, and to the extent that that leads to increased sea level, that could create enormous problems for low-lying countries like Bangladesh. I think that we do have an ethical obligation to deal with transboundary pollution if we're the exporter of pollution causing damage to other countries.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry. I'm here with Ken Taylor and Larry Goulder. We're talking about global justice and the environment. Larry, if I understand you right, and if I just kind of, we've considered these colossi of ethics, John Rawls, professor at Harvard, whose theory of justice was a landmark in the 20th century, and then Robert Nozick, Anarchy, State, and Utopia, who had a different view. But if we can just kind of abstract from the philosophical theories for a moment and say, well, what seems just kind of fair? That sounds like to me like it ought to be a two-step process. We ought to figure out what would be sustainable if everybody were to do it? What level of life, what kind of technology, what kind of cars, what kind of ski lifts, so that everybody over the whole world could have the same kind of stuff, or at least the same level of stuff. And then we ought to develop the technology to do it that way, and we ought to do it that way ourselves and help everybody else do it. So that would probably mean things wouldn't be as much fun in the U.S., because maybe, hybrid ski-doos that sort of thing aren't as much fun as the ones we have now. And it would probably mean that the third world would have to forego some of the fun that we've had in ignoring these things. But that would seem like a fair way to do it. Is that kind of your view?
Well, that sounds like a very reasonable question. I think it's impossible to determine in advance or to foresee in advance what particular products or processes are going to be those that are best for society over the long term. I think there's a different approach that one can take, perhaps from what you were suggesting, John, and that is this. If we look at our current technologies or our current products, such as SUVs, and we factor in the social costs, what we call externalities associated with their use, and we recognize that once you take those costs into account and add those to the ordinary production costs, that the SUVs, for example, are being priced below their full cost to society, what we can do is try to introduce policies that would make the consumer have to bear the full burden to society.
Sounds like taxes.
Well, it doesn't necessarily have to be taxes.
You're talking about a 50-cent per gallon gasoline tax? Or we got to...
Wouldn't have to be.
We're going
to
flip-flop
other,
on that?
Other forms of regulations would do it.
Yeah.
CAFE standards, where fuel economy standards, where the SUVs have to meet similar standards as smaller passenger cars.
But let me.
What these things do is that they promote the kind of world I think that you're looking for. That is, if consumers have to face the full cost, whether through ordinary regulation or through taxes, that will give producers the incentives to try to develop more benign products, more benign processes, and will move toward a sustainable world. The move towards sustainability, I think, is very much inhibited by the fact that environmentally damaging production methods and activities often are priced below the full cost of society, or there's not a regulation that prevents people from using those products even when they're producing a cost greater than the value added to
society. Okay, I get your point, and I think it's a well-taken point.
My economist pedigree is obviously coming through.
Well, that's good. That's why we want you here. We want to believe you know something about the real world, you know, since it's a real-world problem. But look...
as close to the real world as economists coming in.
Yeah, right. But let me say... But again, I don't want to be pernicious.
Sure.
But you talked about the cost to society.
Right.
Now, when I think of society, I think of lots of different things. One thing I think of is a body politic that has a shared means of governance and that can use that shared means of governance mutually endorse to spread burdens in some equal way. But but if we think specifically internationally, there isn't anything. There isn't a body politic. Right. I don't know exactly what states exist in with relative. I don't exactly know what to call the situation of states not governed by any shared. But and then you look around the world, half the governments in the world we despise. We would replace tomorrow. Right. Some of the governments around the world,
November 2nd, depending.
Yeah, right.
On
some of the governments around the world, you know, are deeply illiberal. I mean, they're not in the sense of liberal conservative in our body, but they're not. They don't respect individual sovereignty. They don't, you know, they've made these very unwise decisions. They haven't invested. They haven't invested in the education of their people. Their institutions are debased. What do we do? I mean, that's the global situation.
Maybe one of our callers has.
That's
the
global situation. I mean, what principles of justice apply there? Let's take a caller. We'll see if a caller has an answer to this question. Josh in San Francisco, you're on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Yeah, thank you. Well, in terms of this question, I think it's a very good point. I think we do need some kind of international court where pollution problems could be handled in terms of liability. But I wanted to make another point, if I may.
Sure.
So far in the conversation, historically, I can't think of an instance where a major technological change has been legislated. In the past, it's been either a technological breakthrough or market forces. For example, there was never a time when the whale oil producing nations got together to give whale oil to the non-whale oil producing nations. So, I just want to throw in the idea that a technological breakthrough or market forces you know, is generally the prime mover in these kind of major sociological changes.
Josh, that's a very interesting point. I can't resist though asking about hybrid cars. I mean, weren't they brought about by the state of California and other places having these tight smog rules and?
Right. I mean, I can't claim to be an expert, but I don't see a lot of hybrid cars around. I think when the price of oil is $200 a gallon, you know, there'll be hybrid cars everywhere. That's my point, that these forces are, the market forces and technological forces are very strong, and legislative forces are not.
Thanks, Josh. I think it's an excellent question. Larry, I mean, you know, corporations, producers, they generate externalities. They try to put externalities onto somebody else. The market doesn't usually, like, you know, pay the cost of those externalities. So how's that supposed to work?
Well, a couple things. First of all, I think Josh's point is right on. Governments, perhaps happily, cannot legislate particular technologies easily, at least new ones. They can't legislate new invention. But what they can do is create the conditions, the economic conditions that will stimulate new invention, innovation, and ultimately get us the goals that we want. And so in the case, I think, of the California low-pollution vehicle mandate, it's been very effective because it's accelerated the rate of technological change by guaranteeing a market. You can ask the question about what we do in the absence of an international court, essentially, where we live in a world where, in contrast to the U.S., in the U.S., where we have federal legislation that imposes environmental requirements, it's the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, et cetera, on individual states. At the global level, we can't do that. Nations are sovereign, so we need, in effect, voluntary compliance. What do you do in a situation like that? Well, I think there's two scenarios we might contrast. The first case is where it would really require a sacrifice or altruism on the part of, say, the U.S. or a particular country in order to improve the environment. And that's difficult. I think there all we can do is appeal to Rawlsian-type principles and hope that individuals and the public in general will have motives beyond the national interest. But I think there's more hope than that, which is that there are a number of situations in which the national interest and the global environmental interest can be aligned. That's a kind of win-win situation where doing right by the environment or helping another country do right by the environment can be good for the other country. And let me give you one example of that would be in the Amazon, as everyone knows, the rapid rate of deforestation is significantly contributing to atmospheric concentrations of carbon dioxide by really removing a carbon sink from the earth. And that produces problems that is faced by the whole world since the global climate effects are worldwide. So we would like, in some sense, Brazil, for example, to do less by way of deforestation, but is it appropriate for us to ask Brazil to do that? Well, probably isn't if we ask them to take on the responsibility all themselves, because after all, there's population pressures, there's pressures for agriculture that lead toward deforestation. On the other hand, there is a win-win. That is to say, the value to the rest of the world of Brazil's cutting back on the rate of deforestation, slowing down the rate of deforestation, exceeds at the margin the cost to Brazil of making that sacrifice. So if the rest of the world, particularly the consuming countries, the fossil fuel using countries, were able to make a transfer to Brazil, Brazil would be more than compensated. So even in the absence of an international tribunal, right, a world court, we can have certain circumstances where it's in the global interest, the national interest of some countries to encourage other countries to take action.
But how about the case where the offending country is also an extraordinarily rich country, like us? I mean, it wouldn't have been very fair to tell the Australians that they ought to pay the marginal cost of us cutting down on ozone since they were the beneficiaries of not having an ozone layer. I mean, I'm maybe a little confused here, but
that wouldn't be unusual, John. Let's take a caller. And Philippe in San Francisco is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Philippe. Allison.
Yes, Allison
is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Allison.
Thank you very much. I feel that we are so fortunate and blessed in this country that we have a moral obligation to cut back on our own use. I didn't drive a car for 10 years. I do drive now, unfortunately, but I think it's important that we all cut back.
What kind of car do you drive, Allison?
A Subaru Legacy. I don't like the gas mileage.
Let me ask you a question, Allison.
I think that's acceptable.
Are you willing to cut back even if nobody else does anything? So if the Chinese go pell-mell developing, start driving SUVs, and you say, okay, I'll cut back. Are you willing to do that even if there isn't shared activity around the globe?
Absolutely.
Oh, that's interesting.
I think it's so
I expected you to say no.
So, you expect me to say no?
Yeah, because I know who goes first. You know, if you go first and nobody else follows.
Well, good people like Allison do, yeah. Ken. I'll have to introduce you to some of them.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to let Larry wants to respond to your question. Thanks for the call, Allison.
Well, on one level, it may be for some people onerous for U.S. to take action when other countries are not. But on another level, there are many unilateral policies that the U.S. could take, even if they weren't accompanied by similar policies in the rest of the world, that would be beneficial in the U.S. For example, I mentioned SUVs. Same thing would apply to reduced emissions of carbon dioxide, in that some of the benefits from that would occur in the U.S. And even though the U.S. would benefit more if this happened on a global basis, the U.S. still can benefit by taking unilateral action.
So we wouldn't just be suckers if we took
unilateral action. No, there are lots of environmental policies that satisfy a benefit-cost test, even if the scope of the benefit-cost analysis is just national. Of course, that doesn't solve the political problem, because there may be very strong vested interests that can block these policies, even if they're in the overall national interest.
We've got an email question or comment from Martin in Berkeley. Doesn't the third world have a huge opportunity right now? If they are going to build a new infrastructure anyway, why not build a hydrogen distribution system instead of a gasoline system? They could build sustainable technologies and be leaders in the near future. I don't. That's the end of the question. I don't know about that particular example, but I know that in the case of cell phones, Europe kind of really leapfrogged us because they didn't have a very good wire phone system, and they really have much better cell phones.
Yeah, that's right. It was a good outcome, perhaps for bad reasons. But
you're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're speaking with Professor Larry Golder of Stanford University about global justice and the environment. We'd like you to join our conversation. In our next segment, we're going to talk about the political realities. I mean, Larry, you make it sound so reasonable that we should adopt these policies, that we should live this new way. But we're not doing it. I mean, there's some pressure. But so why aren't we? Is it possible? Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Philosophy Talk, we'll be right back.
They got smog and sewage and mud. Turn on your tap and get hot and cold running crud.
Tom Lehrer singing about pollution. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Joining us is Professor Larry Golder of Stanford University. Is it realistic to think that Americans and other developed countries may someday start consuming less or more efficiently or in this renewable way? I mean, join us. Is it politically realistic? Join us. Tell us what you think. Area code 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Or email your thoughts to comments at philosophytalk.org. Larry, I was just pushing you a bit. I mean, it's nice that there are some of these nice scenarios. It all makes economic and moral sense for us to kind of help Brazil get where it wants to go without destroying the rainforest. But I wonder, aren't more radical solutions going to be needed if we're going to really have a just, fair, ecologically sustainable system? What are the philosophical principles with which we should think about this? I mean, we have two sets of obligations to people not in our own state. I guess that's a problem, because most theories of justice like Rawls are based for kind of people making decisions within a state. And then the whole issue of future generations. I mean, suppose we said, hey, to hell with the environment, let's party.
We say to heck.
To bleep with the environment, let's all agree not to have children and then just party. Would there be anything wrong with that?
Well, that's a question for you, Larry. I mean, we're going to just leave the Earth. After we're done, it's going to be an empty husk. But nobody else is coming along, so big deal. We're going to deplete it, you know, use it up. Like life. You use up life, use up the Earth.
I would think that many notions of justice apply not only at a given moment in time, but intergenerationally. Mm-hmm. And it'd be hard-pressed to think of a serious conception of justice which says that we should live high on the hog at the expense of all of our descendants. Well, the questions may be, you know, how much might we be willing to make to enjoy life more at the cost of future descendants? But living completely high on the hog seems to be out of place.
And it seems to me similarly, and maybe even more obviously, that the, you know, to say, well, our country is doing fine, let's live high on the hog. But I mean, is really being across the Rio Grande, is that really mean we have no obligations to these people? Do the people in Liechtenstein really have no obligations to the people in the rest of Europe? Certainly we need some handle on justice that allows us to make the point that seems obvious to a lot of people, that the moral thing for the U.S. to do is to really radically cut back on its consumption of scarce resources.
I'm going to let Philippe, Philippe's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Philippe. What's your question or comment here? Are you there, Philippe? I think we've lost Meredith is on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Meredith.
Hi. Yeah, I was wondering if you guys could talk more about how which technologies go forward are influenced actually by the control that multinational corporations and powerful interests have over technology policy. For instance, you know, Bush blocked the Kyoto Protocol because the oil and the big three were opposed to it.
So just reading between the lines, you think Bush is unduly influenced by large multinational corporations?
Okay. I don't think you have to read between the lines.
Okay. I just wanted to double check that I had that right.
Meredith, what do you think, Larry?
What an interesting thought.
I mean, is the economic situation in our country such that the large corporations hold such sway that, you know, we couldn't go to these new technologies?
Well, there's a well-respected or generally believed doctrine in political science, which helps explain the power of special interests. And that is, when you have a particular group with relatively small numbers that has a great deal at stake per person in a policy decision, and you contrast that with a very widely dispersed group with lots of people in it, but each person in that other group has a very small stake, it's the small number group with a strong concentrated interest that can dominate the political process, because after all, they are the ones that are willing to suffer the cost of getting involved in politically, getting in touch with the congressperson, etc. And we face a problem like that, I would suggest, in the U.S. and in other countries, in that the energy industries are a concentrated group. They have their own interests. And they would, on a per-person basis, suffer significantly, at least certain the coal-based industry, would if we had a very significant carbon tax or significant reductions in CO2 allowances. That said, there may be a way around it, which is, again, compensation schemes. If you can find methods of compensating the existing industries for doing right by the environment, help them make the transition out, they may be willing to get behind these policies, and I think that's the key. Now, many might feel that's ethically onerous, that we don't owe anything to these polluting energy industries and we should just hold firm, but I think you got to compare the outcomes here. If we don't apply the compensation, then we may be stuck with the status quo, which
could
be
pretty bad. One of the things I hear you saying, because in several different tones of voice, yeah, is that market forces alone, just the free market operating, is not going to solve this problem, right? I mean, it's not going to solve it.
And the presence of these externalities or pollution effects, yes.
Right. So we have to have some kind of governmental, sort of transnational kind of bodies that aren't just corporations, but are that somehow
whether it's at the local, state, national, or international level. That, I believe, would enable us all to achieve sustainability sooner and better. The problem, of course, is political.
So, but now here's my question. How do we get these structures in place, empowered in the way that they need to be empowered to impose these, you know, on corporations? I mean, we have a government right now that's saying, you want it, Mr. Corporation? You got it. I mean, and this is a government chosen by us.
It would be audacious of me to say I have an answer to that question. We seem to have answered it partly at the federal level. We, within the U.S., have the authority of the EPA. At the international level, my colleague at Stanford, a law professor, Buzz Thompson, mentions that there's a very firm principle, unequivocal principle in international law that says that thou shalt not do damage to other countries through various activities within your country, such as through pollution. But We don't have anything that requires countries like the U.S. to actually go to court and face the requirements.
Yeah.
So they have a legal obligation without any force behind it.
So we need something so that Australia could sue us for the damage we've done to the Southern Hemisphere based on principles that already exist.
But, I mean, we never get a court that can actually require that.
Well, on that note about what the future holds, many possibilities, and it's yet undetermined, but we have to end this conversation here, Larry. It's been a pleasure having you on Philosophy Talk.
Thanks very much.
Thank you, Larry.
So, John, what do you learn today? You're wiser? I mean, wiser?
Every day in every way I get wiser and older and more senile, Ken. You know that. Well, it's a peculiar situation. I think I have a vision of what's right. The only problem is I don't know exactly what principles make it right, and I don't know exactly what to do about it.
Yeah, that's where philosophy begins.
Yeah, it seems to me that what we need to figure out a lifestyle, including where we get the energy, what we do to the earth, what we do with the energy after we've used it, how we pollute. That really makes sustainable sense for the whole world. Yeah. The U.S. and the European countries that have high technology development abilities ought to figure it out and ought to apply to themselves and everyone else, just as Professor Goulder, I think, suggested. But why exactly that's right, what principles of justice make it right, and how we get there from here, there's a few details to be worked out.
Yeah, quite a few. You know, I think in my old age I'm turning into even more of a one-worlder than I used to be, because I think, actually, I really think the deep problem is that we share the globe, but we don't have a shared polity in which we can deliberate about how to share the globe. And we need to have something that gives us the capacity to govern together our lives for our mutual advantage, just like we do within a nation. You know, we have these systematic means of distributing burdens and benefits, and we don't really have that transnationally. But you know, the modernity has forced us into the situation. We can't be like little ships passing in the night. We've got to have a life together.
Maybe as a one-time experiment, since the President of the United States is the most powerful person in the whole world, we should let the whole world vote on who gets to be president.
Oh, now that would be a good one. Of course, we know what that outcome would be.
So the polls in Europe suggest Kerry's a bit stronger
We're drifting into politics. Yes, we're philosophers, not politicians. I mean, we did want to ask, when we talk about what justice demands, and then once you do what justice demands, you got to ask, what's the real world going to allow? If you'd like to, we could talk all day about this. You know, we're not done. If you want to continue, you can join our online forum at www.philosophytalk.org. That's philosophytalk.org.
They paved paradise, put up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
It's time for Philosophy Talk Goes to the Movie.
So, Ken, you seen any good philosophical thrillers lately at the local multiplex?
Well, you know, I saw not too long ago Spider-Man 2, and I think it could have been written by a philosophy major. It's a really deep movie.
The philosophical thread is this kid, Peter Parker, is undergoing existential anxiety. He's just been fired from his job as a pizza deliverer. He keeps missing appointments with his girlfriend, who's getting a little bit PO'd, because of the demands of being Spider-Man, which for some reason remains a little obscure to me, he doesn't want to tell her about. One way to look at this basic conflict in his life is in terms of self-actualization, a term philosophers use for the duty or the opportunity, depending on the philosopher, to develop your own talents. But he's got two rather divergent sets of talents, not enough time to develop them both.
Yeah, I mean, the reason he's such a screw-up in his everyday life is because the demands of being Spider-Man are tremendous. I mean, these two lives don't fit together in one life. You know, he's a hero, but he wants a life of his own. He wants loves, he wants long-term commitments, but he can't have any of those things. So Peter Parker's got this problem. How do I be true to the people in my life? How do I give them what they deserve of me? And the way it gets resolved at first is Peter Parker gives up being Spider-Man.
Now, one of the problem that Spider-Man and Peter Parker share seems to me to have an ethical dimension to it. Philosophers talk about the difference between killing and letting die. That is, you know, it's a pretty bad thing to kill someone. It's maybe, arguably, not so bad to let them die where the dying isn't through any action you do. Almost everybody agrees that you shouldn't feel too bad about all the bad things of any sort you could have prevented if only you had devoted your entire life to preventing them, and that seems to be the way Spider-Man feels about things.
Well, there's a scene, there's actually three scenes in quick succession that really articulate this problem in the movie. This first scene, he's walking past an alley, and he sees two guys beating the living daylights out of another guy. And, you know, if he were Spider-Man, he could stop that in an instant. But he's given up being Spider-Man. And he looks on ruefully, and then he just walks away. The next scene is with his aunt. And somehow Peter Parker feels responsible for his uncle dying. I don't remember the details. You remember the details of that?
Yeah, he had an opportunity to stop a robbery, but the people being robbed were people he thought were real jerks, so he didn't do it. But then the robber goes on, carjacks his uncle, and kills him. So he feels that his uncle's death is his fault for stopping that earlier robbery.
And he fesses up to that to his aunt. And she's deeply hurt by this, it seems, right? And he feels like she's not going to forgive him. And then the immediately next scene, there's a building on fire. And Peter Parker rushes in, as Peter Parker, not as Spider-Man. He's still giving up being Spider-Man, to save a kid. And when he comes out, the firemen say, "You got a ton of courage, kid." And they say something about somebody on the fourth floor didn't make it. And just a subtle change in the look on his face, he's crushed because he realizes that if he were Spider-Man, he could have saved both those kids. And that's when he decides he's got to be Spider-Man again. He can't give it up.
It's all very nice. But I must admit, I have a little bit of a problem with the plot. Is I could never quite understand why he didn't just tell everyone he was Spider-Man and earn a good living and make Kirsten Dunst happy by signing autographs or posing for pictures when he wasn't saving people.
Who would do that? Peter Parker would do that, or the Spider-Man would do that?
They're the same guy, Ken.
Yeah, but there's two lives. There's two lives that can't be integrated.
They can't be integrated because he's keeping the Spider-Man identity a secret.
But wait a minute. But think about MJ. And because he loves Kristen Dunst as MJ, he keeps it a secret from her. Why? Because if he told her, she would be involved in this life. Spider-Man's got all these enemies. If the world knew that Peter Parker was Spider-Man, then all they have to do is go to Peter Parker's friends and kidnap them or hold them hostage or murder them to influence Spider-Man. So he's got to keep it a secret. Well, it's a lonely life being Spider-Man.
This is the engine that runs the kind of Hegelian triad of the movie. I mean, he's got this problem, and he first resolves it by just being Peter Parker and not Spider-Man. Then he runs into the difficulties and the guilt trips that Ken just described. So he decides to be Spider-Man and give up the Peter Parker side of his life, and he tells Mary Jane that. I think there's an ethical problem that unless Spider-Man solves it, he's not going to have a very good life, even with Kirsten Dunst, because he doesn't know where to draw the line about his responsibilities.
Right.
I mean, it seems like he should really be spending all of his time going around the city looking for people to save.
I agree. That's a deep problem. Again, the last scene with MJ, he just hears a siren. And he goes off to save this person. Like, he doesn't have a choice. He goes wherever there is a person in need. And how can you do that? How can you live like that? Kristen Dunn's in for a rocky road, I think,
yeah,
in this next movie.
I wouldn't be surprised if that astronaut doesn't come back in her life.
Yeah. Oh, well, they're going to kick us out of here because we've been talking too much.
It's not just Spider-Man's problems we like to pick apart. We're interested in yours as well, particularly if they've kind of got a philosophical bent to them. Maybe you're worried about the nature of time or the nature of space, or maybe you have some ethical conundrum. Give us a call or send us email at conundrums@philosophytalk.org.
Yeah, we can't promise we'll solve your problem, but what we will do is we'll help you think about them in ways you had never imagined before.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Copyright 2004.
Our executive producer is Gordon Earle.
Special thanks to Peter Crimmins, Nicole Sawaya, Roman Mars, and Alan Farley.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Hoover Institution, the Greenwald Foundation, and the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
Also from various groups at Stanford University, from the Friends of Philosophy Talk, from all the members of KALW 91.7 Information Radio, San Francisco's oldest FM station, where our program originates.
The views expressed on this program, though reasonable and true and deep and profound, do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford or of our funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.